Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Belva Davis, host of the public television program This Week in Northern California. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Barbara Lee, Congresswoman representing the 9th Congressional District of California and author of her newly published memoir, Renegade for Peace and Justice, Barbara Lee Speaks for Me. There is nothing that more clearly describes Barbara Lee's place in history than the first paragraph on the cover of her book. It reads, Congresswoman Barbara Lee willingly stood on principle, and it earned her unsolicited international attention when she was the only member of Congress to vote against a resolution giving President George W. Bush virtually unlimited authority to wage war against unspecified organizations and unspecified individuals for an unspecified period of time in the wake of the horrific events of September the 11th. Some praised her vote as heroic and inspirational. Others called for her death. Welcome, Congresswoman Barbara Lee.
Glad to be here.
You know, I was at a reception for you soon, I think maybe the weekend or the weekend after that vote. And I think then you were just getting used to the idea that others might want to do you harm for what you had done. Were you surprised? You were just getting protection from some authorities, I don't know, Secret Service or whatever.
Yes, Belva, I was very surprised. And first, let me thank you for your friendship over the years. We've known each other for many years. And so it's really an honor to be with you this evening for this conversation. I really was very surprised because in a democracy, I always thought that a very key element of our democracy is the right to dissent, the right to offer a different point of view, especially when the tide is going in one direction. I mean, when you have no debate, when you have no dissent, I mean, you know, we walk down a path where we don't want to go. And so, yeah, I was quite surprised that the death threats came and that even when I talked to those who were opposed to the vote. Forget the Constitution. Forget what the democracy means. It was like, you should have supported the president. You know, you should have supported the Congress. Why and how could you vote against going to war when you know our country has been hit? I said, wait a minute, I'm as tough on terrorism as anybody is. Secondly, I'm the daughter, as I write about in my book, of a military officer. I'm an Army brat, 25 years. My dad served and my stepdad in the military. And so, come on, I'm as patriotic as anyone. That wasn't the point. But I found that many people didn't quite understand really what our country is supposed to be about. And I think it's during those moments that we have to educate people also and remind them of what America stands for. So, yeah, I was very surprised about that.
You're a special person for another reason. You represent the 9th Congressional District, which has a long history of having a very forward-thinking representation there. Tell us a bit about how your career started. You write about it in the book, but share some of your...
Well, Belva, I have to say, and I say this over and over again, that I believe my congressional district is the most enlightened, it's the most diverse, and the most progressive congressional district in the country. I really believe that. Much of what ends up being mainstream begins, of course, in the Bay Area and of course, in Oakland and in Berkeley. And I write a lot about that in my book. As a student at Mills College, I was working very closely then with the Black Panther Party. I was not a member of the Black Panther Party, but I think the Black Panther Party made a major impact and a major difference, not only in the Bay Area, but in the country. They were ostracized in many ways, but what I saw and what occurred with me and the Black Panther Party is I worked on the 10-point program, which they had, breakfasts for children,
in school who were hungry and who were poor. Survival rallies. We gave out bags of groceries. I mean, can you imagine having to give out food and shoes in America? But we did. Lines and lines of people at the Oakland Coliseum just coming out for a bag of food. The Black Panther Party actually started the whole movement toward sickle cell anemia research. Many people in the African American community have the sickle cell trait, sickle cell anemia. The George Jackson Medical Clinic really was the first clinic in the country to begin to test people for sickle cell anemia. And I thought that, and again, I write about this in the book, COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover, and yes, I did get my files, and I see what happened. I mean, I was a target of COINTELPRO and FISA now. You know, I write about, let's don't go back there, because I know what unwarranted wiretapping is. And what domestic surveillance is about, and why we cannot allow our government to engage in that. And that happened very clearly in the Bay Area, more so than in most parts of the country. And so I think out of experiences such as that, out of experiences such as the anti-war movement, this district in the Bay Area, the 9th Congressional District, always had strong leadership with Congressman Ron Dellums, who was my predecessor, my mentor, my friend, who's now the mayor of Oakland. I worked for him for 11 years. Ron went to Congress opposing the Vietnam War with a large mandate from his constituency to do that. And so I just think over the years there's been a tremendous amount of activism and progressive politics. Coalition politics began in the East Bay. The Rainbow Coalition, which I am still a part of, came after Ron actually started the notion of we all have to work together, you know, to make this a better world. And we learned a lot from, I think, the East Bay and from the 60s and the 70s. And much of my earlier life as a young woman came from my experiences during that period. Also, finally, let me just say, when I got involved in politics, as I said, I was a student at Mills College, but it was really through the campaign of Congresswoman Shirley Chisholm, who was the first African-American elected to Congress. But she was also the first woman to seriously run for the presidency, and she was the first African-American to run. And I had a course at Mills, and part of my course requirement was to work in a political campaign. And for those who may remember, that was when Muskie, McGovern, Humphrey were running. But we didn't know out here that Shirley Chisholm was running. And so my professor wanted to, well, part of the course requirement was to work in one of these presidential primary campaigns. When I looked at who was running, I said, flunk me. I am not working in any of their campaigns. Never flunked a class before. But I was prepared to flunk that. I was, like many young people, I say have been, not now necessarily, but I conscientiously decided I was not going to register to vote nor become involved in politics because I didn't believe the two-party system was speaking to the needs of the majority of people like me, young mother on public assistance, black, you know, someone who's been, you know, trying to figure out where to go in my life. It just wasn't a system I thought that made much sense, so I didn't want to participate, even though I was active in the community. But Shirley Chisholm came to campus. I was president of the Black Student Union. We invited her, and she said she was running for president. I couldn't believe it. No one had told me that. So I went back to my professor. I talked to her, and she said, well, my dear, if you really believe in everything that you're talking about, you know, I had a big afro and my jeans and very militant, you know. And she said, first thing you have to do is register to vote and get involved. So I said, well, how do I get involved in your campaign? She says, well, I don't have a lot of money. She said, but you have to make it happen. You have to find out what's going on. And I went back, told my professor I'd reconsider flunking the class now that I found a candidate that I could work with. And how do I get involved in campaigning? And my professor, Dr. Mullins, Franz Mullins, said, you got to make it happen. So I went out. There was really no campaign in the Bay Area. So I talked to my good friend who became my chief of staff, who now is in the legislature, Sondre Swanson, talked to Wilson Riles, Jr., talked to Sandy Gaines, who was in the student body president. We literally organized the Northern California campaign out of my course at Mills. And I passed the class. I got an A in the class. I registered to vote, and the rest is history. And so the East Bay, really, and the people who mentored me and taught me everything I know. I have to pay tribute to them, and I write about them in my book.
If someone were looking for those things that you should involve yourself with if you wanted to be a successful politician in this country, I don't think you've just recited it. You have talked about your association with the Black Panther Party, the fact that you were a single mom, the fact that you were working hard for a candidate that you probably knew would not become president of this country. So we need to know a little bit about your background. You know, what got your back straight and hard and unbending?
Well, you know, you have to go against the grain if you're going to take on the status quo. And as I was writing this book, a couple of things came to me that I realize now I can answer that question. And I write about this in chapter one. I was born in El Paso, Texas, segregated El Paso, Texas, where 2% of the population is Black. But my dad was in the military, and so we lived there. But yet my family was an older, one of the probably 10 or 15 Black families. My mother was actually born in El Paso, too, and her two sisters. So our family was from El Paso. But when my mother went to the hospital, she was in labor. When she went to deliver me, and she was supposed to have a C-section, she was not admitted into the hospital because she was Black. And as a result of that, and I write about this in the book, it was very difficult for her to get in. Finally, they had to call my grandmother, and I write about this, some very difficult stuff I had to write about. My grandmother looked like she was white. Many Black families have this as part of their history. Her father was an Irishman who had repeatedly raped my great-grandmother. And so my mother, of course, has green eyes, and she's very fair, but my grandmother looked like she was white. And so my grandmother said, "This is my daughter. Let her in." And so they couldn't quite figure out what to do. Here you have this white woman with kind of a halfway white-looking daughter, but she still got some Black blood in her, so we're not going to let her in the hospital. And so there was a big battle to get me into this hospital. I mean, get my mother into the hospital. They finally admitted her after the doctor said, "Let her in." And rather than take her in to prepare for a C-section, they left her up on what they called a gurney then, and I write about this in my book, and did not attend to my mother at all. She nearly died. What happened was when it was too late for the C-section, someone realized, well, we better get her in, do something. They couldn't figure out what to do because they could no longer do a C-section. And they ended up doing an emergency delivery. And they actually had to pull me out using forceps. And I had this scar in my eye for years. And so I heard the story as a little girl. I could not believe it. I mean, you know, my mother told me, "Hey, you know, you almost didn't make it. And I almost died giving birth to you. Remember that, Barbara?" You know. And I heard this story as a little girl. And it was confusing to me because I said, my mother, you know, no one would wanted her to get in the hospital to have me. What's going on? That's when I started learning about discrimination and racism and segregation and how horrible and sinister and immoral it was, because my mother almost died and I almost didn't get here. And I believe, and as I wrote this book, hearing that as a little girl forced me to come to grips with some things. And when we left El Paso, Texas, when I was 13 and moved to California, I wrote in my diary, I said, my life has got to be about helping to change things that caused me not to live, almost caused me not to get here, and also help other people and help the Black community achieve equal opportunity and some justice. And so, you know, this passion for what I do really comes from my almost not being born.
Well, your childhood was not past the difficulty of getting here. Your childhood was a challenge unto itself for you to stay a stable and focused young woman.
It was quite a challenge. Schools were segregated in El Paso, Texas. My grandfather was a very active member of the NAACP. My mother was very active in a variety of civil rights organizations. My dad's in the military. And so here we are doing everything right, playing by the rules, yet my dad tries to take his family to a drive-in restaurant in his Army uniform, and he's told, "I'm sorry, but we don't serve," and the N-word was used. Because schools were segregated, my parents wanted us to go to an integrated school, the black school was wonderful in El Paso. My mother went there, but they said, nah, we don't believe in segregation. So regardless how good the school, you're going to an integrated school. The only school we could go to was a Catholic school. And so I went to parochial school for 8 years. And I had friends who were Latino and who were white at school. And they'd invite me to go with them to the theater on the weekends, to restaurants with them. I mean, you know, we were kids. Everybody, we didn't know that there were those kind of differences. And I would go with my friends. I was a member of the Girl Scouts and Brownies. But, of course, I was the only African-American and my sister. And they'd stop us at the door, whatever we were going to, and turn us back. And the rest of my friends could get in. But I couldn't because I was black. And my sister couldn't because she was black. So it was really hard, you know. And I say, and I write about this because a lot of times we forget that this is in recent history that Jim Crow was alive and well, and that there are many African Americans still alive, still working hard to try to complete the unfinished business, because God knows we still have a lot to complete here. Mm-hmm. But my childhood, it was a wonderful childhood. I took ballet, took sewing, took piano. I won all these music awards. I mean, my mother had us in every extracurricular activity you could think of. I fenced. I mean, can you imagine young black girls fencing? Come on. I went to square dances. I mean, you know. So we had an unbelievable childhood, very rich with all kinds of extracurricular activities. And still we weren't, according to America, and according to society, we weren't good enough to go to eat at a restaurant or good enough to go to the theater. And so all of that, you know, as a child really weighed on me heavy, and it still weighs on me. And so that's, in many ways, part of my motivation to work day and night to make this a better country and a better world.
As a young woman, after working for other only one other legislator, you yourself found yourself in the California State Assembly, mm-hmm. With some power. Talk about the transition from being a helpmate to being the one.
That's a very hard transition because I really am very shy, believe it or not. I liked working behind the scenes for Ron Dellums. I enjoyed working with Reverend Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition. I was a statewide chair of the Rainbow. I was his fundraiser for California. You know, I liked that, like a lot of women like the behind-the-scenes work. And so coming out, having to be on the front line and being candidate Barbara Lee for the Assembly was very difficult. It was very difficult because, one, is after you work for such a great statesman as Ron Dellums, I mean, how do you do this yourself? You know, I mean, you know, I've been taught by the master. How do you do this yourself after you've been so close to Shirley Chisholm, you know, and other people who really made an impact in my life? And so me, I don't know. But one thing that happened, you know, people asked me to run. They rallied around me and saw something in me that I guess I didn't see, and encouraged me and mentored me and helped me. And again, I write about this in the book, how important it is for people to help young people along the way and to encourage them. And when you look at my office and when you look at my campaign and when you look at the things we do, we have mentored and continue to work with young people to try to help them go on whatever path they so want to walk on.
As you blossomed, I've traveled with you to Cuba twice, once as the aide and once as the congresswoman, and they were totally two different experiences. Tell us a little bit about your connections to the island of Cuba.
Well, Belva, you know, let me just say, I remember you won, what was it, an Emmy Award? Was it Westinghouse Broadcasting for Yankee Comeback?
Right. That's it.
Yeah, it was a wonderful film. And it was right after Barbara Walters had gone to Cuba. And so we had to really, I won't say fight our way in, but make sure that Ron Dellums, and that's whose delegation I helped put together, was given the type of entree as the previous delegation, but we did it. Mm-hmm. And, it was really an amazing visit. But first of all, I've always wanted to end the blockade of Cuba and work to end the embargo. It makes no sense. It's a failed policy. It's not working. and it has isolated us, not isolated Cuba. So it does not make any sense. And very recently, I actually took the first delegation of members of Congress down on an official congressional delegation and met with Raul Castro and with Fidel Castro. But as an assistant to the congressman, it was working to put it all together, working to make sure that everything worked, and making sure that the appropriate officials and the appropriate meetings were held. And it was a great delegation because we met with the Ministry of Education. We looked at Cuba's healthcare system, its education system. We looked at its financial system. We looked at its judiciary system. So we got a good perspective of that. And we had several members of the delegation to look at the different sectors of Cuban society. So fast forward, and I have been now probably 15 or 16 times as a private citizen. I've taken delegations from my district. I've been on official delegations. As a member of Congress, I'm still, and again, making that transition from staff to member, you know, you're still kind of working to make sure everything is right. So you have a different perspective on how it should be done. But also, you have an opportunity to discuss foreign policy issues or issues around health care or biotech or trade or whatever one-on-one with the top officials and to really make an assessment, your own assessment, of what they need to do or what we need to do to move the ball down the court so that we can have normal relations with Cuba. And in doing that, I'm able to recommend, and I did coming back from Cuba this time to the president and to the Secretary of State and to our speaker, several items that I saw were low-hanging fruit that they should do, mm-hmm. and several of which they have done. And so I think that we're moving forward, but it's not fast enough for me, but we are moving forward. So as a member of Congress, people listen. They want to know your thoughts, and they want to know your ideas. And if they don't even ask you, you have the opportunity to say, I'm going to tell you what we think we need to do.
I want to talk about a couple of legislative journeys you've been on for a while, and that is the whole situation in Darfur. You were able to get your Darfur a divestment bill signed into law last year. Tell us about that long struggle.
Well, I tell you, Darfur is a tragedy. Genocide is occurring in Darfur. 500,000 people have been killed. I have visited Darfur on three occasions. I have been arrested in front of the embassy in Washington, D.C., because I believe as a legislator, you're not only legislating, but when you have to take direct action, you have to take direct action. So you can't give up your activist role when it's necessary. We witnessed, when we were there, a genocide taking place right before our eyes. Family members, men, women, desperate, first of all, to tell us what happened in their villages. Some were traumatized. Some were in stupors. I mean, this is real. People want to go home to their villages. They don't want to live in refugee camps. And what and Bashir, thank goodness the International Criminal Court has indicted him. But the Sudanese government needs to be held accountable for what it has done, first of all. And so the sanctions that we have should stay in place. I'm hearing rumblings that they're trying to maybe lift them, but we've talked to General Gratian and the Obama administration, say keep those sanctions. The bill that I authored and was signed into law allows states to divest, and I believe 15, 20 states have divested now. Students have been phenomenal at Stanford, University of California, all around the country as a result of our making sure that these divestment efforts are upheld in court. And so what my legislation did was allow the divestment movement to take place, but also not allow any company that's doing business that has ties with Sudan to negotiate or receive federal contracts. And there are other provisions of the bill, but it is still not strong enough. We still have to do more, and I think we have to make sure that China receives many trade preferences with the United States. And I don't think the administration, both the Bush nor the Obama administration, has really called China on the carpet about Sudan. I believe if China weighed in with the Sudanese leadership because of their oil and their trade relationships, we'd see a difference overnight. And so we have to do many things. One, on this, which we're doing, I'm on the Appropriations Committee now, and so I'm able to help fund the humanitarian efforts and the African Union. We need their mission expanded. We need more troops on the ground there, AU troops. We need to make sure that the refugees are protected because they're vulnerable. Women are getting raped every time they go out to get wood. And I saw this taking place. They told us, and women, and we've met with many women in Sudan. So we have to protect the refugees, and we have to make sure they get home and have a long-term peace agreement between the South, you know, and the North.
Okay, I'm going to have to move to some of the questions here. The majority of them, I think, at least five or six, have the one question of the hour, and we'll go back and talk about other things. But I don't want several people to be sitting out there wanting to know about health reform.
Oh, yeah.
And before, so we should move fast forward to that, and we'll back up a little bit. I must say there was a lovely picture of you in your book there in Darfur being saluted by officials there, so that was good. But what do you think will happen? We haven't even talked about the election of Barack Obama, but he is so in the news because of the push to reform the healthcare system in this country. Give us your forecast on where do you think this battle is going.
Well, first I have to say the election of Barack Obama was historic, and it had to happen. This previous administration has dug us into a deep, deep hole. And I think this president is doing a phenomenal job. Some are saying he's doing a phenomenal job. Some are saying he's doing too much, but he has to do a lot. He has to do a lot to stabilize the economy, to get us out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and to make sure that health care and education and all of the promises that were made, rightfully so, during the campaign, you know, are kept. On health care reform, I chaired the Congressional Black Caucus, former co-chair of the Progressive Caucus, and all three caucuses, we call ourselves the Tri-Caucus, the Black, Hispanic, and Asian Pacific American Caucus, and then the Progressive Caucus, so really that's a quad caucus. We all have insisted on a health care bill that has a strong public health option in that bill. We've insisted on that. And more than insistent on that, we have, and as recently as today, I've communicated to the White House, and we've been on this for many months, that we have at least 60 members who say that's a condition for our vote. And so we don't want to see this go down. We want real health care reform with a public health option. But there's some of us who are going to fight till the end for this. Many in this area want single payer. I support single payer, H.R. 676. And the practical realities of the Congress won't allow a single-payer bill to get through. And so short of that, we have to have a strong public health option. That in itself will drive down the cost of premiums for those who want to keep their private insurance, which in this health care bill, in all of the bills that are in Congress right now, that's a basic requirement, and will allow for a health care system that won't exclude one because of pre-existing conditions. It will allow, if you like your health insurance now, you can keep it. It's about choice, and it's about competitiveness. You have to have a public health option to be competitive with the private sector, to drive the private sector numbers down. You just have to do that. And there's money. You know, they keep talking about where are we going to pay for this? Well, we paid, spent over $1 trillion on this war in Iraq that did not need to be fought. That's the first thing, you know. So there's money, and we all have to fight hard for it. And so we're in the thick of it right now, and we're going to continue to fight. I don't know where it's going to end up, but I do know the president, as late as today, said that he still supports a public health option. And we're taking him for his word. We're helping him, and we want to make sure he succeeds.
Well, I have to say that to remind those in the audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program, and we're talking with Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Another question from the audience saying, asking about the control of the debate, that the Obama administration and the Democrats seem to have lost control of the debate. What would you say to that?
Oh, I'd say the media, the mainstream media, is being very biased in their coverage of the debate. I didn't see CNN cover my town hall meeting. You know what I mean? And so there are town hall meetings all over the country where you see thousands of people showing up who support health care reform. And so what has been focused on has been the ruckus that is taking place by a very small minority in this country who probably did not support Barack Obama anyway and want to create confusion and want to engage in a political struggle with the administration. And so the Democrats, we're on it. You know, we have different parts of our party. We have Blue Dogs, New Dems, Social Dems, Progressives, Black Caucus members, Hispanic, Asian. You know, but we all have our focus and our interests. That's what democracy's about. But we're working very hard to get one good bill that has a strong public health option out of the House. And that's what we're doing. And so I would urge people to let your members of Congress know that you support them, you support what we're doing, and that you support what we want to do long-term with universal, affordable health care. We have to hear from people. You know, I don't know if the grassroots movement is alive and well like it should be right now. You know, we need a campaign. We need people hitting the streets. We need the media coverage of the people's voice in America demanding health care reform. And so we've got to encourage people to hit the streets and to do what they need to do to make sure that, that our voices are covered. But I can assure you that the Dems have control of our message, and the media at this point has not quite, I don't think, been fair and balanced in covering what is taking place out there.
Well, is the public option a deal breaker with the Congress, Democratic control, but being so far apart between the Blue Dogs, say, and the Progressives and so forth? What could bring these sides together in order to get a bill that you'd be proud of?
That's what we're working on now. I mean, it's give and take in the process and the art of negotiation and what we have to do. I mean, we've given, unfortunately, single payer to the public health option. I mean, that was a big concession for us. And so we have to get other members to understand that this was a big concession and come halfway. And so this is, you know, negotiations that are taking place. And we have, like I said, there are many of us who are saying that there won't be the votes to pass it. I don't believe if there's not a strong public health option, but I have to believe there's going to be one. The Speaker supports it. The President supports it. You know, we have most members of Congress supporting it. And just in the last day, with the ruckus coming out of Washington on the administration backing off, as I said earlier, I did talk to the White House, and they've assured me the President has not backed off of a public health option, and we're going to stay with him on that, and people need to let him know that that is the type of approach and the provision of the bill that's a must-have in any health care reform.
Talk about what it's like to be in a Congress where the Democrats control both houses and the White House. Does it meet what your expectations are? One day we will be in the majority, or has it been... You've had some difficulty getting adjusted to the diversity within your own party.
Oh, we've always been adjusted to the diversity within our own party. So that hasn't been very difficult for any of us. I think it's important for us to recognize that we've gotten the job done in a lot of areas. I mean, we made sure that we got the Children's Health Bill passed. We got the Lilly Ledbetter passed. We've got some a school bill, higher ed bill passed. We've passed many, many bills that have been signed into law. When you look at what the president has done by executive order, even on Cuba, we see some movement on Cuba. When you look at what has taken place just in the first few months of this administration along with the Congress, it's phenomenal. With me as chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, we have a black caucus that speaks with one voice on so many issues. When you look at the economic recovery package, there is no way we would have gotten $500 million in, for example, for green job training
you know, because there's so many who have been left behind, not just in recent economic downturns, but historically, who won't be prepared for the new industry, the new green industry. So we had to fight to get, but we got it, training money. And we were able to make sure that many of the targeted tax provisions in the economic recovery package were targeted to areas where unemployment is the highest. And so we've made some major impacts, not enough, but we've done a lot. And so I think it's a very good place to be, a good time to be a Democrat, recognizing the responsibility that we have to make sure that we do speak with one voice and that we do support the president. But we also must remember, and I remind all of the caucuses that I'm a part of, that we're the legislative branch. We're not an echo chamber. You know, we have to support the president, yes, but, you know, this is a democracy. You have three branches of government, and so don't always think that it's going to be like 100% all the time lockstep. I mean, we have a constitutional responsibility for oversight, you know, for developing the budget. I mean, we have our specific requirements, and so don't be mistaken on that point. But I think that the majority of Democrats support the president. I certainly support him. We're helping him a lot, and we're going to continue to help him to be the greatest president ever.
Mm-hmm. Has he disappointed you at all on any issue?
No, he really hasn't. No, he really hasn't. And let me just say, I was the first member of the Californian delegation who endorsed Barack Obama when he ran. For a long time, I was the only one out here. I actually worked with him when he ran for the Senate. We helped him get elected. And I know what a great person he is and what he wants to do and how he wants to do it. Now, there have been times when I did not agree, for example, when he put up Judd Gregg as an appointee for the Department of Commerce, the Republican senator. I said, wait a minute. And so I looked at his record, and I told the president, shared this, and said, this man's record, he's voted against the Department of Commerce. He's voted against funding for the census. He's voted against minority women-owned business enterprise development. Department of Commerce is a key agency in our economic recovery efforts. And so I raised this, and I raised it very publicly, the questions. It wasn't taken on the administration, but it was like, hey, did you all know this? And we see that finally that appointment did not stand, thank goodness. But I think it's our congressional and constitutional responsibility to, when we see things maybe happening that may not be good for the country, that we say so and that we take a stand. And it's not in any way disappointing, but it's, to reference the president in a disappointing way, it's just like, look, we think that this may not be as good. We may have a little more information, and we may think you want to reconsider this. And so, you know, it's a very, I think his relationship with the Congress and with all of us is very good.
Well, you are a feminist. You're from a district where women have prevailed a lot. What contribution, what new direction, was there some added ingredients as the number of women increased within the Democratic Party and within the leadership positions in the House?
Well, first, I have to just thank our great speaker. Nancy Pelosi really is the greatest speaker ever. I mean, she has made sure that women have a seat at the table on each and every issue. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm on the Appropriations Committee. And there is no way that, and I've been working on this for many years, and this year we were able to do this, to really get rid of this abstinence-only policy, which is not serving our young people well. And as a woman, you know, I write about this in my book, comprehensive sex education is very important for young people in terms of the prevention of HIV and AIDS, of sexually transmitted diseases. Yes, abstinence, but you know, if a young person is engaged in sexual activity, they need to know what to do to prevent the spread of diseases and to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And so it's been women who've been leading that fight in the Congress. And when you look at the struggles and fights we're having around gun safety, you know, there's a woman whose husband was shot and killed out of New York who has been phenomenal. We still can't get gun control like we should. because of the politics of the NRA, but you see women leading the charge on that front. When you look at all of the issues on ag, and when you look at health care, in fact, when it comes to health care reform, Congresswoman Donna Christensen, who's a medical doctor, and she's the second vice chair of the Black Caucus, she really started leading this years ago on health disparities. When you look, and we have many of the provisions of our bill, the Health Equity and Accountability Act, included in all of the three bills that are moving through the Congress. It's a woman who has done that, and so women in the House and in the Senate have been at the table on each and every issue, and I don't think the Lilly Ledbetter law would not have, it never would have gone through the Congress had it not been for women and the leadership of Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro and other women. And so women have made a tremendous difference and will continue to make a tremendous difference. And we've got to protect Roe versus Wade and a woman's right to choose. You know, that's got to be, because we see anti-abortion legislation coming through the House all of the time, and we have to beat that back. And it's women who are leading the way, beating back all these very terrible anti-abortion amendments.
You were certainly not a big fan of President Bush. Are there still remnants from the Bush administration that are pulling some levers in Washington today?
That's a very good question, and I think, yes, there are. There are a lot of remnants of the Bush administration, and I think it's very dangerous. I think there are many policies, though, that have not been revamped yet that are Bush-era policies. I mean, we're trying to re-regulate in many ways, or at least put some form of regulation on the financial services industry. I was on the Financial Services Committee for 8 years and saw the whole deregulatory movement coming. Only a few of us voted against Glass-Steagall. That was the bill that deregulated the banks. And so we haven't been able to put the pieces all back together, and I think that's what's so great about Barack Obama. He's trying to dig ourselves out of this hole, and the Congress is trying to do it too. But, you know, we have Guantanamo, we have torture, we have, you know, the CIA, all of the issues around the intelligence community. And so there are many, many issues that have to be unraveled. And it's going to take some time because that Bush administration did a lot of damage to our country and to the world. And so I'm glad we have a president who's an agent of change and a speaker who's an agent of change, because if they only wanted to tinker around the edges, we'd have the Bush administration remnants around for decades, and I think we're going to be able to unravel them. And let me just say, you know, I think former President Bush, he was an interesting man. He was funny. You know, he could joke all the time. You know, but I think Dick Cheney and the people around him, the way they destroyed the country and what they did was unconscionable, and I think sooner or later, well, I was one of the first ones who went along with the resolution of impeachment for Dick Cheney and for President Bush, because I think that there were some serious crimes that, you know, probably were committed, and I think we should have investigations into what happened during the Bush administration. And I don't think we can just say that was then and this is now.
On the subject of war, that was one of your main objectives to get out of Iraq. And now we're going into Afghanistan. How are you feeling?
Well, of course, I voted against the supplemental because it had money for Iraq and Afghanistan. I don't believe, and many don't believe, that there's a military solution to Afghanistan. We're digging ourselves deeper in a hole, and I see another Iraq happening. And I'm hoping, and we've talked to the president about this many times, and he certainly gets it in terms of needing a more comprehensive policy toward Afghanistan, but was waiting until the elections and to really make a determination with regard to how we need to shift gears. I did not support the increase in troops going into Afghanistan. A lot of members of Congress did not support that. And I think we have to really come to grips with what our foreign policy is in the Middle East and in Afghanistan and Iraq, and make sure that you know, that our troops are not in harm's way. And when you look at what's taking place, the more troops that are inserted into Afghanistan, the more danger there is and the more volatile it's becoming. It's not making Afghanistan any safer, and it's not making our national security any more secure by that. And so we have to figure out a way out and a way to help stabilize the country. I mean, the poppy seeds, you know, we've got to find alternative sources of income and economic development for the farmers because, of course, heroin is coming into our country and it's grown in Afghanistan. So it's very complex and complicated, but the drone attacks, killing civilians, I think that they've begun to stop those drone attacks, but I've been very much opposed to them because too many innocent lives have been killed and taken as a result of that. And so it's a very complicated situation, but I think we're going to have to have a little bit more street heat, too. You don't hear many people raising their voices about our involvement in Afghanistan. It's pretty quiet out here. And so people need to focus on what's taking place and really help the president. He needs the political support to begin to really shift the direction and to make sure that we don't end up with another Iraq.
He did, in the campaign, talk about going into Afghanistan.
Yeah, he's keen, yeah.
He warned that that was uh-huh. his plan.
Yeah. And he, I didn't agree with that. But, yeah, and he's keeping his campaign promise that the shift should be from Iraq into Afghanistan and, of course, Pakistan. And I think, you know, until we have a regional approach, until you bring in the countries in the region and figure out a plan that's based on security arrangements, diplomacy, economic arrangements, nothing I don't think is going to work. And I think that's where they want to go with that. But I'm not sure right now, and one of the reasons that I opposed the supplemental was that the balance in the funding was so far off, it was like 95% military, 5% if that, you know, economic diplomacy and what have you to stabilize the region. Again, he did say it very clearly, and he's doing what he said he was going to do. It's just that there's some of us who think that we need to go back to the drawing board on Afghanistan.
Another question, but at first I should remind all of us that if you're listening to us on the Commonwealth Club's radio program, we're speaking with Congresswoman Barbara Lee. Question, can we expect a higher standards of personal and financial morality from our elected officials in the future? Do you consider, I'm not sure, the one of the gang, I'm not so sure about that, but can we expect to continue to hear the kinds of stories that we've heard about the influence of lobbyists and others?
Mm-hmm. Well, as one who supports public financing of campaigns, I think we need to get money out of politics. And we need to have a strong public financing law. The political will at this point is not there for it. We've developed some very strong ethics regulations and requirements and laws. We have ethics commissions, committees, and all kinds of ethics, you know, compliance requirements. But I think until we come to grips with public financing, you know, money's going to be in politics. It costs millions of dollars to run for elected office. And that's a shame and disgrace. Yeah, it keeps out people who don't have money or people who don't have access to money, good people who would be great members of Congress or great public servants, elected officials, can't run for office because they can't raise the money to do it. And so we have to have a system that's fair and equitable, and I believe public financing is the way to go.
Mm-hmm. There's some more follow-up questions. There's so many of them about health care, so we'll return for a couple of them. This questioner says, what about Medi-Cal for all as an option?
Medicare for all? Well, you know, when you talk about Medicare for all, Medicare has been probably the most successful health program in the country. And, in fact, those who are opposing a public option, half of them have Medicare. and so, yeah. I think what we're talking about in terms of Medicare, you know, is similar to what a public option for those who don't have insurance would be. But I think in America, you know, you're going to have the private sector still in the mix. Now, as a single person who supports single payer, I don't necessarily agree that profits should be made in an industry that's based on health care and based on issues around life and death. That, to me, just seems wrong. But this is the system that we have here. And I think we've got to take on the insurance industry. We've got to make sure that they don't continue to be the decision maker in health decisions. The health decisions have to be and should be between a health provider, a doctor, and the patient, not an insurance agent who's making some determinations on whether or not a procedure is going to be paid for or not. I think that's outrageous. And so our system is extremely flawed, and I think what we have seen over the past is that health care has been a privilege. It really has been a privilege. And I think it should be a basic human right. It is a basic human right, and hopefully we'll get there soon. But at this point, we're not there.
You talked earlier about your trips to Cuba. This question is, are there any insights from the Cuban healthcare system that could be applied here?
Sure, there are many insights. And let me say, so many of our young students here can't afford medical school. And they brilliant young people who just can't get into medical school, they can't afford it. Some schools here in California, unfortunately, the end of affirmative action has kept young students of color from entering. When you look at the numbers, Prop 209 did a number on us. And so we were able to get into the Latin American Medical School in Cuba. There are probably about 150 American students there. And I've had several students from my district studying medicine in Cuba who have graduated and have come back and are doing quite well. And so I think, and part of the deal was they go to Cuba, learn Spanish, receive their, and it was a great medical education. They have to promise to come back and serve in underserved communities. And so I think that's one part of, I think, Cuban medical education that's important, is that once one receives the type of education that's taxpayer-subsidized or where you have some support, that students understand that because of the healthcare needs in our country that they be required to help contribute back. And I think our students want to do that. Secondly, Cuba's healthcare system is it's very interesting. I've visited some of the biotech center there, and they have some unbelievable vaccines, hepatitis, I think B vaccines. They're looking at some medicines and treatments for diabetes that we here in this country could really benefit from. And so if we had normal relations with Cuba, we could have these scientific and health exchanges. And I'm promoting some of my biotech companies to go down to Cuba to visit with the biotech industry there, because I think that there could be some major collaborations taking place in Cuba. I've had friends who've gone to Cuba because they couldn't get certain medical procedures here. They went there and they were able to receive them. I mean, no healthcare system is perfect, but certainly everyone in Cuba has access to decent, adequate, affordable health care, and no one is denied based on their income status and based on where they live and what have you. It's a system, I think, that's worthy of looking at. It when you look at their community clinics in the neighborhoods, I think you saw that when we were there, the CDRs. You know, every community within a certain radius has a health center. The doctors, the nurses, the health providers live in the community. People go to their community health centers for preventive care. They go there when they're sick. Then they're referred to the hospital. So it's a very decentralized system based on, and the community's really involved in the type of services that are provided in those community clinics. That's all over the country, in rural and in urban communities. And I think that's a very interesting model to look at in terms of access to health care.
This returns to another topic where you work diligently on the Darfur crisis. The question is, what can civilians do to help alleviate some of the suffering there?
There are many organizations that are relief organizations that are raising money and food, clothes, just humanitarian efforts. So I would encourage anyone who wants to get involved to get involved in the humanitarian efforts because people are desperate in Darfur and they need our help. Secondly, Save Darfur Coalition. There are many, many young people around the country, many the faith community, and many organizations that are doing political work. And I would say get involved in the political work and get your members of Congress. The Bay Area delegation, though, has been phenomenal. So get your friends and your families throughout the country to get their members of Congress focused on working with us to support our efforts, such as trying to get China to come to the table to help develop a better strategy to end the genocide. And so there are a lot of things we can do. And feel free to call my office to get a list of the organizations and things that you can
You are chair of the Congressional Black Caucus. Mm-hmm. So this questioner asks, what are your thoughts on affirmative action today?
Well, my thoughts on affirmative action today are what they were 30 years ago, and I wouldn't be sitting here as a member of Congress, someone who received a fine education if it hadn't been for affirmative action. You have to level the playing field. Discrimination has been and continues to be alive and well. When you look at what has happened in California as a result of Prop 209, and when you look at the fact that you have very few African-American Latino students in the University of California, something is wrong. When you look at what has happened in state contracting for minority and women-owned businesses as a result of Prop 209, something's terribly wrong. Very few contracts now go to minority and women-owned businesses. When you look at employment opportunities for minority and women in state efforts, and again, Prop 209 affected the state. You know, Ward Conley, an African-American, led this movement. And when you look at how affirmative action has ended in California and what has happened to people of color, it is shameful. When I look at the fact that the majority now of students entering historically black colleges and universities throughout the country are from California because, in essence, they're not wanted here. I mean, these colleges are wonderful colleges. And these students, thank God, have historically black colleges to go to. But we learned a couple of years ago there's this real brain drain in California now because once students leave, they don't come back. And so just in terms of the African-American community, we're losing population in California for a variety of reasons. But one of those reasons is the end of affirmative action. And until this becomes a colorblind society, until there's a level playing field, we have to have affirmative action. And I will fight to the end to maintain affirmative action.
Another hot topic. Has Congress done enough to make sure that we never see another meltdown like the financial one that we're going through?
I don't know if we've done enough. We sure have done a lot. This bailout was a very difficult one. One is CEO compensation hasn't been addressed as adequately as I'd like for it to be addressed. And I hope one day my bill gets passed, which is a bill that I think would really help address it. And it's picking up some steam. And what it says is that any CEO making 25 times more than the lowest paid worker at any company, you could pay him a bonus, whatever you want to pay him, but you're not going to get a tax deduction, a federal tax deduction for that, because what we're doing is we're subsidizing these CEO bonuses and outrageous salaries. And so we have to address CEO compensation in a big way. Secondly, we've got to regulate the financial services industry. I don't think we've done enough in re-regulating them. I mean, you know, I understand market forces and that the market has to survive in a capitalist country. But I also know you have to have some form of regulation. You can't have what has happened over the last 8 years. It's like the Wild West. Thirdly, with regard to the foreclosure crisis, I think we should have a moratorium on foreclosures. A moratorium. People are losing their homes now, yes, because of subprime and scam loans that these loan sharks engaged in and led people into, but also people are losing their jobs, losing their health care. They don't have the money to pay their mortgages now, even 30-year fixed mortgages. So we have to deal with the mortgage industry, and we've done a heck of a lot. But we have to do more, and I think we should have a moratorium on all foreclosures, at least for 6 months.
In terms of the stimulus package and mm-hmm. how it's working within your district or within in California, do you think it's doing what was intended by the president and by the Congress? Mm-hmm.
I think it is doing what's intended. It's going to take a while to see it all shape out and shake loose. But when you look at the jobs that are being created, I was just driving around yesterday and saw so much road work taking place. You know, that's stimulus money, road repairs. When you look at the summer youth job program, many young people were hired as a result of the economic recovery package. When you look at the green job initiatives in the Bay Area, much of the green job initiatives received a boost through the economic stimulus package. When you look at the fact that there were not more layoffs of teachers, it's because we backfilled the state in terms of helping to make sure that layoffs didn't occur in a worse way than what they have occurred. And so it's working, but I think, and I actually wrote a letter, Congresswoman Woolsey and myself wrote to the president and said, we thought that, was it $800 billion was inadequate. We thought at least $1 trillion should have been put in that first stimulus package. We couldn't get the political support, but I think now they see what we meant. It was not big enough. We need to have another one. We have to extend, and I'm working on this with other members, to extend unemployment compensation now because it's about ready to run out. We've got to extend just the safety net, food stamps, unemployment compensation, all of that we put in the stimulus because you had to help stabilize people's lives. People are falling through the cracks. And so a lot of the criticism was, well, why are you putting money into food stamps in a stimulus package? Well, come on, people have to eat, first of all, and people, if you use food stamps, you're keeping your local grocer in business, grocery store in business. And I want to know, well, why are you putting money in for school construction? Well, you know, school modernization, schools are, buildings are dilapidated. Are you creating jobs by helping to renovate these dilapidated schools in many of our communities? Why are you putting more money into clinics? Well, you know, people are losing their jobs, so they need some form of health care until they can get their job back. You know, so yeah, it's working, but we need a heck of a lot more.
Several questions about you and your background and why you're able to do what you do and take the positions that you have. And I know in your book, which the title is Renegade for Peace and Justice, Barbara Lee Speaks for Me, you talk a lot about your faith. Mm-hmm. Can you expound on how you became, and I've watched you in the environment of your own congregation mm-hmm. in the East Bay, how do you work all of that together with your ambitions for the future?
You know, and I, let me just say, probably one of the strongest defenders of separation of church and state. And I do believe in that we cannot cross that line. For me, faith works in many ways. I mean, I grew up in a family that was not over the top religious, but my grandfather was a member of the AME Church. He was a member of the Board of Trustees. My mother was a Methodist, and I was a Catholic. I went to Mass, St. Joseph's, every day of my life almost until I left El Paso. You know, I studied the catechism, studied the Bible. I mean, how would I not be a person? And some of, even though I'm not a practicing Catholic, but the values and what I learned and through the teachings of the Bible and my catechism really served me well in terms of my values. I mean, it's my duty and responsibility to feed the hungry. That's a issue of faith. You know, it's my job as a public official to look out for the least of these. That's, you know, a call for my faith. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my duty and responsibility to make sure that people are treated fair and just. I mean, that comes from my faith. And so I write about that. Not that I think that people who don't have a religion or a faith aren't, can't and don't do, because I certainly do. I know many people who don't have any religion who probably are doing more than some who I know who have faith and who go to church every day or every week. And so just for me personally, that's what I draw on to help me withstand some of these storms that I have to weather all of the time. Everybody draws from different parts of their being and their spirit. But for me, and there's certain scriptures, boy, I can go to. I mean, you know, like in Ephesians, the book of Ephesians, after 9/11, And I write about this in my book. There's a scripture, I remember the chapter, but it's in Ephesians, and it talks about when all hell breaks loose, what do? You just stand. You just put on the armor of God, and you just kind of stand until things settle down, because God's going to protect you, and you're going to be okay if you're right and if you think you're right. And don't be swayed by all the stuff that's going on around you. You just stand. And so there are many, many scriptures in James, the book of James. It talks about faith without works is dead. I mean, it's like, talk about your faith. Well, if you're not doing something to live your faith, why do you have faith? I mean, come on.
We're down to our last seconds right now. So I have to know, do you have fun sometimes?
You know me, Belva.
I thought I would save that to the very last. Well, our thanks to Congresswoman Barbara Lee, author of Renegade for Peace and Justice. Barbara Lee speaks for me. We thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Belva. It's been fun.
We want to remind you that the Congresswoman will be signing books in the lobby immediately following the program, so please do allow her time to get quickly to the table. And again, I'm Belva Davis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Right, this was